Saturday morning. I'm used to cold weather, and it feels to me like spring has sprung, but it may be winter for you. I'm glad to see you this morning. In terms of our subject this morning, and actually throughout the day, we have much more material than I'm going to be able to cover. So what I'm going to try to do is be selective of several of the things that I would otherwise say. The subject that we're going to be talking about this morning is the subject of alcohol. And last night we kind of introduced the concepts of what addiction is all about. This day I want to try to be very practical with you. And having laid the foundation last night, what I want to do is to try to instill in us some things that will help us understand and be able to work with persons who are addicted, with families that are addicted, and we'll try to make this real practical today. One in five people are addicts and may not know it. There is a genetic predisposition toward addiction. That is, we don't know when we put the chemical to our lips whether we are turning a switch on that won't turn off, or whether we're in that other percentile that can take it or leave it. Sometimes we find people say, well, I don't know why they just don't quit. And for those that say that, they probably have an experience or have been around folks or know folks who've been able just to quit. But for about 20% of the population, they are not able, once they turn that switch on, it does not turn off. It is on for the rest of their life. I assessed a young man who was 16 years old. He had been seeing a psychologist, and they weren't getting anywhere, and he was referred to me for an addictions assessment. And what I found out from this young man was that on his 16th birthday, his father had taken him down to Mexico and was going to celebrate his 16th birthday by getting him drunk and finding a prostitute for him. Quite a birthday for him from a father. But aside from that, this young man, I asked him, said, well, how much did you drink the first time? He said, oh, a bottle of tequila. And I thought he was fooling, I thought he was messing with me. But I later found out that he wasn't. A bottle of tequila, including the worm. And I said, well, what was it like for you? He said, well, I'm still walking around, but not very good. That amount of tequila would normally kill most people. It would throw most folks into alcohol poisoning. But this young man at age 16, on his 16th birthday, was already an addict, and he didn't know it. That is, his tolerance level was already so high that he had passed by some of those early social stages of addiction. And so it is that as I work with individuals that are addicted to chemicals, we find this to be true over and over again, that there is a population of about 20% that are addicts and don't know it. Now, this becomes an issue because addictions beget addictions. That is, when we have one area of a life out of balance, another area of, and we get that into control, another area pops up. It's kind of like those things in the, when you go down in the mall, you ever do that thing, you hit the thing with a bat and two or three more pop up and you try to keep them all down? That's how addictions work. That really is kind of a nice visual for addictions. And that is that one addiction, one compulsion, when it's under control, will another one arise. That behavior will come again. So what we see is that here's a person that gets their marijuana under control, and now their alcohol gets out of control. They get their alcohol in control and their marijuana in control, and here comes a sexual addiction. And then we may have a gambling addiction. Or we may have a compulsion, and I will speak later on about this, to have a spiritual addiction. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that a little bit later on today. But we have some that are obsessed with the spirituality way beyond what the Bible teaches. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Those are the folks like the Jim Joneses and some of the extremists. And those actually take on the very same forms of and progressions of addiction. So a person can be addicted in a number of different ways. Basically, we're talking about compulsive or obsessive compulsive behaviors. Alcohol is the number one killer of people under the age of 24. It kills 5 times as many Americans as illegal drugs combined. We're spending $15 billion on the war on drugs annually, and yet we allow billions of dollars to be freely spent to promote the drug that kills more people than any other drug. So said Congressman Joseph Kennedy II on May the 16th, 1996. Congress recognizes there's a problem with alcohol addiction. Between the ages of 2 and 18, the period in which most social senses and social learning occurs, and when it's the most intense, the average American child between those ages sees over 70,000 commercials for beer. It becomes very much as we watch videos or as we watch movies or even as we're down riding down the road, we'll see beer, alcohol, Smirnoff, whatever the brand is. And so what we need to worry about is not about necessarily the drug that's going to kill a child tonight, but alcohol is going to kill children this evening. Or this day, even as we stand here and speak. Alcohol is deadly. Women are usually introduced to alcohol by a guy. That's usually the passage there, that some guy tries to get the woman drunk, usually in early life. The men, on the other hand, tend to come to alcohol in terms of a rite of passage. And so it may be when you're 21, but most of the time that's an extremely late age for most folks these days. And so so we have people that socially we gravitate to alcohol. And I want to tell you something that we're really struggling with right now. I work with veterans, formerly homeless veterans, and what we're dealing with our troops that are coming back home and those who are already home, we're dealing with a massive alcohol addiction. What our guys will tell us in the military, everything is celebrated with alcohol. You have a kill, you go drink it away. You have a victory, you go have a drink. You're on leave, you go have a drink. And so it's all about, here's how we learn to socialize and how we learn to kind of unwind at the end of the day. We had several things last night that we talked about. I'm going to rehearse a little bit of that in just a moment, but I'm going to rush because I've got some family things I want to talk about that I've kind of jammed in at the end of this lesson that I think we need to talk about. When we were talking about the subject of alcohol and recovery, I think we need to say a few words in these presentations about the subject of Alcoholics Anonymous and about the 12-step programs. Those are the most popular programs in terms of where do you go in the secular world to get support. And basically the philosophy there with your AA groups is that this is addicts helping addicts. This is that 20% who understand what they're going through that can help others to find the way through that journey. And I want to make it very clear that is not a therapy group. That is a support group. There's a difference in a support group and a therapy group. A support group is there to support, to understand, to lend help and guidance and direction, but therapy gets down into root causes. And so there's a major difference in those two types of groups. But what most of our folks don't realize is the 12 steps of AA actually had Bible verses by them to begin with. They were heavily rooted in Calvinism to begin with, and some of the literature will read kind of Calvinistic. But one thing I learned as I got into this field is that this sounded strangely familiar, and the Bible verses have been deleted in the 12 steps. And I'm reading that, and it's like, well, this is coming to repentance. This is forgiveness. And it started matching up. I'd been preaching for about 17 years by the time I got into this field. And it's like, this translates. And so a lot of what I do in my therapy sessions comes right out of the bigger book as I relate it to the big book of AA. And so these match very, very much. I don't have any problems recommending someone goes to AA or to the other support groups. The other support group that's going to be there for families is Al-Anon or Narcanon if a person's into narcotics. But the Al-Anon groups basically are there to give support to the family, to talk about how we can detach with love, how we can not buy into the addiction, and how we can avoid loving the person who is addicted, literally love them to death. That is, by doing so much for them that we help them down the road further into their addiction. And those groups are out there. Most of those groups meet 24 hours a day. While I'm on this, lest I forget later, there are support groups for a number of other things, depression. There are support groups for sex addicts. We'll talk about that sexual addiction this afternoon, but I'll say this for now. And those are all 12-step groups. They follow the same 12 steps. The first step is a surrender step that basically says that we admitted we were powerless over whatever the substance is, and that our lives had become unmanageable. There are several operatives in that. The first three words of that first step is we admitted we. The we is there for a reason. And the we is there because those who are trying to recover have come to the knowledge that we cannot do this alone. I cannot do it alone. We need each other. And thus the concept of a fellowship of recovering people that you'll find in your AA circles. We admitted has to do with acknowledging that there is a problem. And then the thing that we admit is that we are powerless, that is, that the substance has gained power over me, and I don't know how to turn it loose. And my life has gotten unmanageable, that is, all the ramifications with family, with bank, with finance, with job, the whole sphere of life, that it's all gotten all balled up together, and it's become unmanageable. Now, that first step is critical because the first three steps are the steps that lead us to what AA calls a higher power. You and I recognize that higher power is God. And we also recognize the role of Jesus and the Holy Spirit in this. And so that's very compatible, but the steps of AA are a little bit more general than we would have in a church service. But it matches. It walks across okay for us. What I want to suggest is that we talked last night about cravings and about that being one of the main hallmarks of addiction. That is, the craving, once it kicks in, the mind begins to obsess, and what the mind dwells on, the body begins to act on. So we have preoccupation. We start looking for ways that we can satisfy this craving. Here's the good thing about cravings. The bad thing about cravings is that you have them when you're recovering because physiologically your body's demanding the chemical. It's gotten used to it. It may have replaced some of the things that are already in your brain and your normal neurotransmitters may have shut down. So the body's asking for more and more. Just like your stomach tells you when you're hungry, the mind tells you when this chemical's not there. We also have body memories. So whatever we've done with our body, whether it's a thing, for instance, you pop the top to a Pepsi can, and some of the guys that kind of can set them off. It's like that sound of that pop top reminds them of, oh, it sounded like a beer or whatever. So we've got a lot of triggers, kind of things that fit in with these addiction. The Greek word there's a Greek word that's often translated, or that is translated oblivion. You've heard people say, well, I just want to go out and drink myself to oblivion, or he's drinking himself to oblivion. That word oblivion is interesting because what it means is to forget and be forgotten. And that's exactly why a lot of folks get into the alcohol habit, is they want to make it go away. Forget and be forgotten. In AA, we talk about several things in terms of recovery. And there are indicators in a person's life that they are heading back toward a relapse. And here's some of those indicators. In the big book, on page 151, it lists the four horsemen that come charging in to basically bring us back into relapse. And what that is terror. A person may be having fears. They may be realistic or they may be unrealistic, but they are fears nevertheless. And those fears begin to charge in. Then there is confusion, otherwise in the big book known as bewilderment. And so I'm confused. I'm not able to figure out things about life. I'm getting frustrated. The next one is frustration, where we lose patience, we're unable to control things. And then the fourth one is hopelessness or despair. When those things start happening in a person's life, they're feeling closed in on, then the likelihood they'll go back to that which is familiar, back to their addiction or their alcohol, that likelihood is greatly enhanced. There are several anacronyms that we use. I'm going to get to some verses here in a minute. But several anacronyms we use that we ask our people who are addicted to take your inventory. And what we mean is take a look at what's going on with you. We would say, a person asked me the other day, how you doing, Art? And I'd been so busy, I didn't know how I was doing. I had to stop and think. And you ever have a day like that? It's like, how are you doing? I didn't want to say fine because my doctor told me I couldn't say that anymore. So I had to tell him the truth. So I had to stop and take my inventory as to how I'm feeling. We need to check in with ourselves once in a while. We get so busy sometimes we haven't checked in lately. In our recovery, the addict has to check in very regularly with himself. So how are you doing? And we want to, here's the scan. Hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. Now those anacronyms spell halt. Stop. Check in. When a person is hungry, that hunger may be a physical hunger, but there are other kinds of hungers. We also may be emotionally hungry, starved for relationship. Or we may be spiritually hungry, starved for relationship with God. We can be hungry on several fronts. But when we check in with ourselves, what's going on? Where are you feeling empty somewhere? If that's true, then what we need to do is get to a meeting to get with other people. By all means, don't isolate. Don't be alone when you're hungry. Because that hunger is going to get greater and will beg to be filled. That's what relapse is about. So we need to check in on that. The other one is angry. Now, anger can go a couple of different directions. Anger can be projected outward, in which it may go into forms of rage or lashing out verbally at somebody. It may get physical. And we see that sometimes with domestic violence in the extreme. And so anger may go out. The kind of anger that I get more concerned about is the anger that doesn't go out, but the anger that goes in. Anger turned inward is the working definition for clinical depression. And what happens very often with addicted persons is they don't deal with the issues that life faces to them. They just keep stuffing it and stuffing it and stuffing it. And after a while, we get so full that we either explode in anger or we go take the edge off by going back to our alcohol. These are the things that drive the addictions. Hungry, angry, and the other one is lonely. By the way, with depression can also take the form of dysthymia. And dysthymia is a low-grade functional depression, and this is the person that looks sad all the time. We see it sometimes in the early stage where we say, you know, he seems like such a sad little boy, or she seems like such a sad little girl, and I don't ever see him smiling. That's the early forms of dysthymia. We don't have the range of emotion, and much of that is because we're stuffing things that we need to talk about to deal about. Your mother ever tell you to watch out for the quiet ones? You ever heard that? Well, in recovery, watch out for the quiet ones, because those are the ones that are going through life and they're not processing what's going on with them. They're stuffing inside, and I guarantee you, sooner or later, your trash can's going to get full, and you're going to need to dump it. And you may find some odd places to do that. You may get into the addiction piece with that. But lonely is the next one. Lonely has to do not with being alone. Some people are very comfortable with themselves. Most addicts aren't. But lonely has to do with that feeling, again, a feeling of emptiness, a feeling that nobody wants me around, I don't fit. And I hear a lot of those that get into their alcohol, go out to the bars or the strip clubs or go out to their garage or down to their bar or wherever their stash is at their house. And what they'll do is they'll drink that feeling of isolation, I don't fit. The way the one gentleman put this is, Art, I'm on the outside of life looking in. I'm on the outside of my family looking in. I don't fit. I don't belong there. I want to be there, but I don't fit. And his coping style for that is he goes, pops a few beers, and then he's Jolly Joe, and the family obviously doesn't want him around. They're praying he'll either come in and fall asleep, or maybe he'll pass out in the garage, this particular one's even passed out in the driveway, and they just left him out there. That's not normal. That's not normal. We don't have folks laying out in the driveway. When you grow up in a family like that, and that does become normal, we have some real distorted views on what family is. For a long time, I struggled with the why does God visit the iniquities of the fathers upon the third and fourth generation? What is that? This third and fourth generation didn't do anything. And then it dawned on me as I got in this field, and there's a correlation in some of the research studies, that when a family starts into recovery, it takes four generations for that to work through the cycle. Now, if one of those generations brings it back in, it'll still take four generations, so we can delay that. But essentially, what addicted families do very subtly is they teach their families how to live an addictive lifestyle with the avoidant behavior, with the addictive stuff that we're going to be talking about this day. Well, halt, hungry, angry, lonely, and then tired. Tired has to do with maybe being physically worn out. It may be that our brain is tired, and we just kind of want to shut things off. And so it may be that we go use the alcohol. Those four things, hungry, angry, lonely, tired, are all triggers for the addict. Now, here's the problem. When you get those in combination of onesie, twosies, or all four of them, then you've got a relapse right there on top of you. Let me add another element here called pause, post-acute withdrawal syndrome. Most folks, when they go into treatment or when they try to get some help, they will go through a detoxification process, and then that's followed by some introduction in rehabilitation. Those lengths of stay have gotten very short with managed care. That is your insurance that says that you have coverage for it, but you find out later that you don't have a lot of coverage, or it only pays at 50%. Don't get me started on managed care. But what we see is that after that period of time in detox and rehab, then that first year in recovery is an extremely difficult time for the addict. Here's why. Because physiologically, the body is adjusting. The fog really hasn't lifted by the end of that 7 to 10 days. Most folks that have been drinking pretty heavily, the fog is starting to lift about week 3. And they're able to start thinking again. Unfortunately, when they start feeling like their mind's clearing, they start thinking, I'm well. And so I can go out and do like I used to, just not drink. And unfortunately, what happens is once they get that kind of thinking, AA calls it stinking thinking, but once they get that kind of thinking going on with them, it's not very far to the next relapse. Because even as our Bible says, let him that thinks he stand take heed lest he fall. It's the same principle here. So in terms of the tired, the person in recovery is going, in terms of pause, the person in recovery is going to do what's called hitting the wall. They're going to be sailing along in recovery, and all of a sudden, smack. You have a using dream. You feel like you've used the night before. You wake up the next morning, and you don't really know when you first wake up, did I use last night? I feel like I'm high. I feel like I'm drunk. Now, depending on what chemical, if it's a drug, what chemical you use, there's a residual with that because part of the chemicals are stored in the fatty tissue of the body and part are stored in the water tissues of the body. Cocaine stored in the water tissue, but marijuana is stored in the fatty tissue. What that means is you have a time-release capsule in you as that chemical dissipates in your body, and you're going to have those feelings. Okay? That's the consequence of getting in this lifestyle. So what we find is that with pause, about every 30 to 60 days, the person hits the wall. So we start having using dreams. We start getting confused. Things that we used to be able to make decisions on very easily, just normal things like, do I go down the street and put gas in the car? That becomes almost a major task. And we're really having that bad day. Let me say this. Pause, post-acute withdrawal syndrome, is a normal part of recovery. And if there is one single thing that pumps relapse, it is that post-acute withdrawal syndrome. Those bad days. What I'm really saying here is in the first year of recovery, there are waves. It's up and down. Now we overlay that with life stressors. We overlay that with what's going on with family or the loss of job and those other things. Now we've really got some complicating factors that mean this person is really going to need the support of their brethren and of their support group. That's where we admitted we. We is there for a reason. You can't do this alone. There's too many things. This is overwhelming as our body is trying to recover. This is a consequence of what we've done to ourselves. And what I would say to those that are recovering, be patient with yourself. Okay, I think I'm ready for this. Okay, I want to look at a few verses right now so that we keep this on task with our purpose for the weekend. Peter said, we read this last night, talked about that Christ suffered in the flesh, and that we should cease from sin, verse 2, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lust of men, but for the will of God. For the time past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles, having pursued a course of sensuality, lust, now look at these words, these three words, drunkenness, carousing, drinking parties, and abominable idolatry. First look at the company that's keeping, and you can see that that's not the good company. The next thing you look at here is that these are the desires of the heathen, not of the child of God. So we have to refocus our desires. And the next thing I want you to see is those three words that we'll look at in just a moment. And all this, they are surprised that you do not run with them into the same excess of dissipation or excess of riot, and they malign you. We looked at that last night. Now let's look at these three words. Drunkenness, carousing, and drinking parties. The definitions on these are three different Greek words. And basically what we see, the excess of wine, that has to do with a person who has fallen down drunk, staggering in the streets, not necessarily remembering what happened the night before. It's an overflowing of wine. This is a person that goes out and they literally get sloshed, okay, and may not even remember the night before. What our verse say? It says that we're to stay away from that. The time past is sufficient for these desires. So that's something that has to go away. The next word is the word revelings, and this word means a nightly carousal, half-drunken, revelry, or drunken parties. Now these two words describe what goes on at the clubs, what goes on where there are open bars or even pay bars, what goes on when people go get a fifth down at a liquor store, or come home with a 12-pack or whatever it is they're buying. These words describe that. And that's what people are doing. The Bible says in this verse that that's not what Christians do. That if you want to have a relationship with God, AA calls that higher power, but if you want a relationship with God, you can't be doing this. These two things don't fit in the same basket. And so you got to stay away from that. But the third one is important as well. This is the word carousings. And this has to do with drinking, not of necessity, excess. A drinking party or to sip. This is the person that we call they nurse the bottle. That is, they go into wherever it is they're drinking. Someone says, here, have a beer. And they put a bottle in their hand or a can. And so this person kind of sips on that throughout the evening. Now, the definition of what I'm talking about here is social drinking. And a lot of my brethren disagree with me on this. But that's what that word's about. When we see what if you could see what I see on a daily basis with people who are trying to get away from this stuff, and if you could see what I see in terms of in terms of 20% of the population that are addicted and don't know it, when they put that first drink to their lip, that sipping, then there's 20% of the people that are going to be alcoholics for life. It will always be a problem with them from that point on. And according to this definition, which is the definition of the word, it has to do with social drinking. And look at this. All three levels of this are condemned. I'm going to look at another verse here. We looked at the DSM the other night. We'll pass over that one. But the power of addiction is that it is cunning and baffling and deceitful. And someone has said this. We talked about pain last night, that basically we're trying to run or to avoid something. And that's what alcohol does. It helps us to avoid dealing with life, takes the edge off, or puts us where our restraints are not there. Here's what alcohol does to you, actually, in your brain. It puts the front part of your brain to sleep. It numbs that front part of your brain. Guess what that is? That's where your center of conscience is. That's where your value system is stored. Now, we put that to sleep. What are we going to do? We're functioning now when we're drunk. We're functioning without our value system. Does that have anything to do with why guys want to get a girl drunk, see if they can have their way? Of course it does. We put the frontal lobe of the brain to sleep, and then we don't have a conscience. What it also does is the front part of the brain is your regulator. It regulates your behaviors. And what we see is here's a person maybe is angry, but now we don't have the regulator in place, and so we end up with a term, he's a mean drunk. He's nice when he's sober, but he's a mean drunk. What are they talking about? This thing's put to sleep, and what's in there, all that trash that's in there is coming out because the regulator's shut down. Does that make any sense to you? That's what alcohol does. It shuts the regulator down. And, well, we have people doing things that are out of character for them. But actually, maybe aren't out of character. We're going to talk about that. Maybe they're in the character all along. And with the regulator shut down, now we see stuff that comes out. It's like, where did that come from? It didn't come out of the air. It came from somewhere inside. We talked about a tolerance last night. I just want to keep this before you. And the idea here that you have to use or drink more and more to get the same effect. Okay, what this basically this particular chart is about is a person starts maybe with a social drinking, and it takes maybe some wine cooler. Somebody gets a little tingle with a wine cooler, but after a while, that wine cooler ain't gonna give you that tingle. It's gonna take something else, or maybe two or three wine coolers, or you may shift to something else. And that's where we see people then getting to the shots and to the hard liquor and all that kind of stuff, because they're trying to chase that buzz and they're not getting it. And then on the bottom end of this, this is where hangovers you've seen them. You've seen people that are the lifetime drunks that really have trouble even functioning around people anymore, even when they're sober. That's where that takes you. Because you lose your sense of what's normal. We talked about the brain the other night, here's alcohol and cocaine. What I want to suggest is that we are to make no provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. What that means, as we apply it to here, is don't stop by the liquor store and stock up on your stash. If you're trying to recover from alcohol, then get it out of your house. I could tell you about Listerine Larry. He's one of the guys that I work with. But Listerine Larry. Larry, we have to manage his money. Because if he has any money in his pocket, when he goes to the store, he'll buy whatever has alcohol in it. Vanilla extract. Can you imagine drinking a whole bottle of vanilla extract to get drunk? And he drinks to get drunk. He'll drink a bottle of Scope or some other kind of thing. Sometimes he smells a little funny, but we have to watch Listerine Larry, because if there is money in his pocket, there's alcohol in his body. Money is a major trigger for him. That's why we manage his money for him. We're told, be not among wine bibbers. Now, if we understand that passage, here's the wine bibber, that's the wine sippers. If I understand that, that would tell me to stay out of the places where folks are drinking. Don't go around where folks are doing this. Why not? Because at first, we may have the prohibition about this. But little by little, we begin to break down to where these things become normal with us. And it's not very long then before we start doing what it is that we weren't going to do. Be not among wine bibbers. Wine is a mocker. Strong drink is a rage. And whoever is deceived thereby is not wise. That's another way of saying, if you're going to drink, you're stupid. What it says. Now let's look at this. Who has woe? Who has sorrows? Who has contentions? Who has babblings? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? The answer, they that tarry long at the wine. They that go to seek mixed wine. You see that mixed word? That's mixed drinks. Who would ever thought it? God talked about this. So He does give us all things that pertain to life and godliness. Look not thou upon the wine when it's red, when it gives its color in the cup, when it moves itself aright. At the last it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. Thine eyes shall behold strange women. That's your barflies. That's the people at the club out in the meat markets trying to pick people up. And thine heart shall utter perverse things. Yea, thou shalt be as he that lies down in the midst of the sea, and as he that lies upon the top of a mast. They have stricken me, shalt thou say, and I was not sick. They have beaten me, and I felt it not. The body's numb, somebody rolls you or beats you. Had one guy who was beaten, he came to my office the next day crying, and he says, I got drunk last night, Art. I know I shouldn't have. I got drunk last night, and something's wrong with my arms, and he's black and blue. And he was a black man to start with. But he was messed up and bleeding. And we took him, and he had two broken arms and several fractured ribs. And he didn't know what happened. They stricken me, shalt thou say. And I was not sick. They beat me. I felt it not. When shall I awake? I will seek it yet again. Now look at that word awake. When do you wake up? Most time in the morning. This is morning relief drinking. This is something to take the edge off. They call it taking the hair or chasing the hair of the dog. But taking that relief off. I wake up with a hangover. My head's just thumping. All the noise around me is bothering me. I pour myself a drink. I take the edge off. And I start feeling just a little bit better. Actually, when people get drunk, what they've actually done is they're dehydrating their body. A lot of folks don't know that. That dehydration messes up. By the way, coffee doesn't give you any, it does not take away alcohol. So what you're going to have, if you try to give an alcohol a bunch of coffee to sober them up, what you're going to have is a wide awake drunk. You'd be better to let them sleep. Put them to bed. Don't give them something to wake them up. You don't want to deal with that. It gives you a wide awake drunk. All right, look at this verse again. We got it broken out. Who has sorrow? The PowerPoint doesn't exactly match up right. But who has sorrow? That's an exclamation of their pain and of the uneasiness. Who has contentions? That's about people getting fusses over some of the stupidest things. Who has complaining? That has to do with anxiety. People with a negative attitude. Life isn't right. Everybody's messing me over. Life's terrible. And that's also about setting yourself up to drink. Who has the redness of the eyes? That has to do with dullness. You know, the effects of the hangover. Sometimes are the broken blood vessels even in the eye, the bulbous nose, or the beer belly. Those kinds of things all fit in there. Now look at what happens here. Those that linger long at the wine, what do? They go to a higher percentage of alcohol. They go to mixed wine. Is that what that says? They go to mixed drinks. Okay? What are we doing? We're chasing the buzz. We're trying to increase the alcohol content so we can get the same feeling that we're trying to get. We're drinking to get drunk, and when it doesn't happen, we mix it with something else. And remember what I said last night? Pot, alcohol, and cocaine usually go together. It's been a long time since I've seen just a drunk. Alcohol, pot, cocaine. Those will eventually meet each other with the alcoholic. Now look here, your eyes will see strange things. In our text, it actually says, beholding strange women. This is where we have the pickup stuff going on. We have waking up the next morning, you don't know who you're with. What's this? The blackouts, maybe another man's wife that we're making passes at. And you've heard those stories. If somebody's drunk and made a pass at somebody's wife, or a wife made a pass at somebody's husband, or even those that aren't married, making vulgar passes, coarse language, and basically acting spiritually bankrupt. Then it talks about the one that's in the middle of the sea and lies down the top of a mast. That has to do with reeling and staggering and exposing yourself to dangers, at-risk kinds of stuff, like falling asleep in the snow without your coat on. You can freeze to death. Now they struck me, the text says. That is, we're beaten and we're struck down. We're so numb and anesthetized with alcohol that we can't even feel. Our body is not even cueing us anymore. Does that tell you this is out of control? God's word is sufficient. Do not drink wine or strong drink, lest ye die. That's an Old Testament passage. That you put a difference between the holy and the unholy, and the clean and the clean. I recognize that's from Leviticus. But I want you to look at that. That God's message is there has to be a distinction between that which is holy and that which is unholy. That which is clean and that which is unclean. In the New Testament, what the Bible teaches is there has to be a distinction between us and the world. That's why the Gentiles think it's strange. The heathen thinks it's strange that we don't go with them to the same excess of riot or dissipation. Why? Because there's a difference between the holy and the unholy. We are a royal priesthood. We are an elect nation. We are holy people, sanctified, set apart for God's purposes. We are a kingdom of priests, according to the New Testament. And we are to walk in such a way that we walk with the dignity and respect that is becoming of folks who are the child our relative, our big brother is the King of Kings and he is the Lord of Lords, and we conduct ourselves with all the respect and dignity of royalty. That's who we are. We do not spend our time in dissipation. We do not spend our time out doing what the world does. What? Know ye not that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit which is in you, which you have of God? And you are not your own, for you were bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. Be not deceived. Evil companions corrupt good morals. Remember what I said, young ladies and older ladies, that most women who are introduced to alcohol are introduced by a guy trying to get his way. Here, have a little drink with me. Or come on, go along with it. Or let me pour a little bit in your Coke or whatever it is. And that's evil companions corrupting good morals. Here's the guys out, here's the alcohol flowing, and someone says, well, have a drink. You know, this will be one of the guys. Or sometimes even families get into that. I don't know what's going on. My own daughter won't even have a beer with me anymore. I don't know what's happening. And you're going to run into that kind of thing. The night is far spent. The day is at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness. Cast them off. And let us put on the armor of light. Let us walk honestly as in the day. Not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envying, but put you on the Lord Jesus and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. How can the Lord say it any clearer? How could it be any clearer that we do not make plans to live in the gutter? We do not make plans to go where this stuff's going on. We do not make plans to company with those evil companions who we know are going to corrupt our good morals. There has been person after person that's tried to disprove this passage in 1 Corinthians 15. Tried to disprove it. And everyone who's tried to disprove it has only proved it to be true. Evil companions corrupt good morals. Make no provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. This afternoon we could use that same passage, and what it means there is don't take preparation for sexual stuff if you don't plan to be sexual. When we start making plans just in case, then we've been making preparations to fulfill the lust thereof. Our response, we talked about that last night, and I'm going to go to a little different thing here for the rest of our time. And what I want to talk about is families for the time that for about 12 minutes here. Because addiction does not exist outside of a framework. The alcoholic has to have certain things around him or her to be an alcoholic. And we're going to just kind of talk about some of those. Actually, one in four children live in a home in this country, live in a home where alcohol is used daily. These children are at greater risk for mental illness, depression, anxiety, mood disorders, health problems, learning difficulties, and for substance abuse. We learn, we are social beings, and we learn from our families what are the norms, and we pick up patterns, even though they may not be said or spoken, we pick up those patterns, and we carry them on to the next generations. It's true. The equilibrium of the family is thrown off by the addiction, by living with that elephant that sits in the living room that we're not going to talk about, the insanity that surrounds the addict and the addicted family, where maybe someone drives up and rolls the person out of the car, let's get him home, and they roll him out of the car, and you go out, and there's your son laying in the backyard, maybe puking all over himself. And you see that, but yeah, we're so ashamed, we don't want to get him down, we don't want to call the police, because if we do that, the name will be in the paper. Then what folks are going to think about us? So we take them in, and we do something that actually is very dangerous. We try to get them straightened out ourselves. But we don't know what's going on or what they've been into. And so the family sometimes tries to cover. The family starts avoiding their friends, avoiding their associations, avoiding situations where this person may be there. Family has a lot of guilt and shame. And so what we see is the dynamics of the family, the dynamics begin to change. And then what we find is some very maladaptive things going on in the families. There's a preoccupation with, we have a secret. We can't let it out. We can't tell. So as we said last night, we don't trust. We don't feel. We don't tell. We don't think. And we don't change. And here's the point. If nothing changes, nothing changes. You stay stuck in the problem. Now, there was a guy you've read about, and I'm not a big fan of his, but you've read about Sigmund Freud, or at least you've heard his name. And what he talked about is that we have two responses in our parasympathetic nervous system. Forget that. That's college-y stuff. We have two basic responses. That is, fight or flight. Wrong. There's a third one. Freeze. And that's people's response often with addiction. We're either going to run away from it and act like it's not there. We're going to stand there and confront it head on. Or we're going to stand here and not know what to do. The deer in the headlight. Maybe it'll go away. I don't know what to do. That's freeze. Now, at any one of those responses, that's where we need to be asking for help. That's where we need to have an opening, welcoming group of people that we can say, I don't know what to do. By the way, do you know what the definition of an emergency is? An emergency or a crisis, simply defined, is when the adults don't know what to do. And that throws us into crisis. You ever notice how your heart gets to twitterpating heavier and your blood starts running faster and, you know, like, I don't know what to do. And so we either run, fight, or freeze. And that's the response of families. They don't know what to do. The response of churches sometimes. And again, if we don't do something, if nothing changes, then nothing changes. We'll talk a little bit more this afternoon about that. There's an elephant in the room. And we don't talk about it. But here's what we need to do. Our homes are not designed to be bars. They're not designed to be training schools on how to drink and how to drug and how to have illicit sex. That's not what homes are for. If you don't have house rules, I strongly encourage you to have house rules. Because where there are no rules, anything goes. Some of the families will say, well, you know, I know they're going to try this, and I'd rather try it at home. And so what we do is we pass the bowl, and everybody throws in their keys, and I'd rather them do it here than be out on the road. Wrong. You tell a young person that it's okay to drink at home, you know the nature of growing up, don't you? Wherever the rule is, the guy's going to stick his big hairy toe across the line just to see if he can do it. You get him drinking at home, you teach him how to do that, and I'll guarantee you it won't stop there. Fact is, there'll be those that will teach others how to do it. Last night we talked about the family members, the enabler. The enabler is a codependent person. That is, that the addict is addicted to the chemical, but the enabler is addicted to the addict. What that means is that the enabler has become not the caregiver, but the caretaker. It's my job to take care of you. It's my job to fix you. It's my job to hover and smother over you to where you get better. It's my job to plan where your meetings are. It's my job to, you get the point? And so we began living their life. But here's effectively what happens with the enabler. Ultimately, they become sicker than the addict. Now, it doesn't appear that way, but they become sicker than the addict. Because their life is about hovering and smothering and covering up the sins of that addicted person. Didn't Paul talk to Timothy about that? When he said, be not partaker of other men's sins? Isn't that what that's about? Or at least an application of it. We have enablers. There are lost children in these families. That is, that when there's a lot of when there's drinking going on in these families, what we see is the lost child sometimes. This is the child that doesn't say a whole lot, not a lot of problems, not a lot of troubles, but this is the child you better watch. Because this child doesn't talk. This child is taking in all kinds of information. And the child's not saying much. Oh, they deal with life. They may not even have a lot of friends. But they generally are lost in life. The family attention has been so much on the addiction, on the alcohol, that this child has been robbed of the attention that the child needs. Then there is the superhero. Now, the superhero is the one whose job it is to take care of the family and to make the family proud. If you ever want to see something interesting, watch the movie La Bamba, the Richie Valens story. And what you'll see is Richie was the superhero. He could do no wrong. But his brother was the drunk who could do no right. He was the rebel child. So we have a superhero and then we have the rebel. The rebel is the scapegoat. Whatever's wrong in the family, This one carries all the sins. They can do no right. And after a while, they quit trying. They're the black sheep. And then we have the mascots. The mascots are the family pets, usually the youngest child. And this is the child who's nurtured and babied, and the attention of the family is placed on making this child the pet. We also have the jokester in the family. This is the one that takes the edge off of the family stress by being the clown and by getting everybody laughing, because when we're laughing, we may not be fussing. But often the laughter and the jokes and the things that they laugh at are things that aren't funny. Now, what I've just described is how families conform or tend to conform to the addict, to the person that's drunk or that drinks. They tend to form that way. And what they're doing is they are doing maladaptive behavior. These are abnormal behaviors, out-of-range behaviors that are avoiding the very problem that everyone in that family needs to face. And that is, there's a drunk in this house. But we're not going to talk about it. Don't trust. Don't feel. Don't tell. Don't think. And don't change. When you do, the dominoes begin falling. And when one changes, the whole family system has to go through a change. Here's the other piece. I've seen it time after time. We get an alcoholic that kind of gets a handle on what they need to do to get their life straight, and they heading down the path pretty well. A couple months later, and the family doesn't engage in their piece of the treatment. They think he's the one's broken, he's the one's got to get fixed, we don't need to do anything. And so they don't engage. And here's the addict, goes through, learns what they need to do, they go back, they set themselves in the very place that created the problems that they've got, or at least fed those problems. They're right back in the same situation. And a couple months later, or maybe even as many as a couple of weeks, here's a relapse comes up. And it's like, what happened? And as we get in the group sessions with these folks, what we find out is that the family actually had grown to the point that they could not function without the addict, without changing. And the family became uncomfortable. And they make statements like, I just wish you'd go back to drinking. You are a lot more pleasant than, you know, life wasn't so bad. And they move right back. And then what happens is the family stays in its dysfunction. The family needed that addict to stay drunk in order that they could stay crazy. Does that make sense? Change has to happen. It is hard work. The teacher wrote on my paper a long time ago, in class, I was dealing with some pretty painful stuff. And the teacher wrote this, there is no growth without pain. The journey back is a difficult journey. It requires change, not only for the addict, but for the system round about them that supports that. Now, if we extrapolate that one step further, then we could talk about the church family. And that when we have an addict, we need to find out what has been supporting that person in their addiction. And let's find out how to support them now in their recovery instead. There are many instead ofs, and I'm going to talk about that later this afternoon. Our time is gone. Here's some action steps to help. I'm going to go through these very quickly. The action steps are that in families, we need to repent of any part we have played in helping that addict stay addicted. There may be bitterness, deception, evil speaking, malice, rage, resentment, hatred, or other things going on in this family. For families, that's our side of the street. The addict has to clean up their act. But if these things are going on in the family, then those things have to be put. We've got something on our side of the street to clean up too. Galatians, the 5th chapter, verse 20, and a number of other verses. The prayer that we need to, the thing we need to do with families is we need to pray. Because our battle is not with our loved one. Our battle is with Satan. The devil has laid claim to our loved one. And we will not let him win. God's tools are powerful. They overthrow strongholds. Safety first is another thing I would tell families. Safety first. That is, we cannot let people die. If they die, you can't help them. So, safety first. Here's the other one. The alcoholic has to experience the logical and natural consequences of their addiction. Get this. Until the pain of the addiction becomes stronger than the pleasure of the addiction, they will remain in their addiction. When we take away the pain with enabling or being codependent, we take away the pain. We prolong them in their addiction until the pain of the addiction, again, becomes greater than the pleasure of the addiction. They will remain in their addiction. We need to find people who will listen, who will advise, and who will encourage. We're standing too close to it to actually see sometimes what's there. That can be a counselor. That can be your spiritual leaders. That can be folks in support groups with you. But find folks to talk to. You cannot do this by yourself. You're going to need the help of heaven and the help of brethren and the help of other resources that are available to you. Remember that the alcohol is like the other woman or the other man. This person has an affair going on with a chemical. And by all means, one of the hardest things for families to do when someone is recovering is to let the addict's recovery be their recovery. Stop hovering and smothering them. The addict, if they are going to use, they will find a way to use. If you are hovering and smothering, there is no way you can stop them if they want to use. They'll find a way, and sometimes very ingeniously. Even in inpatient treatment with locked doors, some of our people figured out how to ferment apple juice in the cafeteria. An addict will find the substance they're craving. And so, stop hovering and smothering. Let their recovery be their recovery. But what we can do is we can coach and we can encourage, but we have to claim our lives. Set limits on what we allow in our house. And make it clear to all that you will be there for them. The young lady that I told this, I said, I care too much for you to help you be sick. I will help you get well, but I will not help you kill yourself. We have to set those kinds of limits. Now, there was a study done in Indianapolis, a longitudinal study over 20 years in schools in Indianapolis by a friend of mine, Dr. Zelke. And his conclusion as he studied alcoholic families is he began noticing that there are some people that go through these families and they just repeat the cycle over and over for the family. But there were some that didn't. And he asked in his study what made the difference. And at the conclusion of 20 years of research, here's the answer. The short version. Those that grew up in alcoholic homes and found sobriety as adults were people who had a positive adult mentor in their life. It was a school teacher. It was someone from church. Maybe somebody from the Boys or Girls Club. But there was someone who showed that child there's another way. That's where we come in. Can you imagine what it's like to go home to this stuff every night, day in, day out, not knowing what's going on? Can you imagine? But can you also imagine what it must be like to give that person an oasis in their storm? To believe in them? That's our task. A battle rages in our homes and in the bars and clubs and the private areas across our country. It's within this town. It may be within this church. It may be in our own homes. It's a battle for souls. It's a battle for your soul. It's for your husband, for your wife, for your children. It's a battle. Wars are bloody, and there are casualties. But thanks be to God that there are also victories. That's this lesson. Let's take a break.